Get started with the last presentation for today. One sort of generic comment, and I'm not marking on this comment, but the preferred term in today's client-centered world is adherence versus compliance. Compliance is power-centric in that the patient or the client is expected to comply with the orders of the physiotherapist, whereas adherence implies more of an equal playing field. So certainly when we review manuscripts for Physiotherapy Canada, we always have the authors change the terminology from compliance to adherence. So that's just a little sidebar for your future reference. The next group is the second of the groups that has had a paper accepted. And excitingly, it's going to be published in the same journal the same month. So two papers from UBC MPT students will be appearing in physical therapy next month, which is a real coup and something that about which I'm really excited. And they did an update, which is another type of article, kind of like a short focused lit review. But the reviewers made them almost turn it into a systematic review. It's on a slightly different topic. So I was pleased to supervise this group. They've been just delightful to work with. And they're even taking me out to lunch afterwards. So you know how that can inflate your grade. And you're taking me to dinner tonight, right, Pat? Right. Okay. All right. We'll announce about the luau afterwards, right? Okay, so let's take it away with the next group looking at exercise and quality of life for women with breast cancer.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for sticking around. I know it's lunchtime. So going on the trend that everyone's naming their groups after their respective body parts, you can call us Team Breast. And like Susan just said, our topic today is the effects of exercise on quality of life in women living with breast cancer. I'd like to start by introducing ourselves. So we have Maureen Ruddick, Dara Story, Corrine Wong, Kathy Brown, and myself, Deanna Pachego. So how it all started. It's been quite a long journey, and it started on a balmy summer's night back in 2005, July. The five of us had a shared interest in breast cancer research, which brought us together to work on our literature review, and that was exercise for women with or at risk for breast cancer-related lymphedema. And as Susan just said, and with her help, it was accepted for publication in next month's Physical Therapy Journal. We originally planned on carrying this topic over to our systematic review, but unfortunately, during the process of writing our update, there was a systematic review that came out on it entitled Physical Therapies for Reducing and Controlling Lymphedema of the Limbs by Badger et al. 2004. So after blood, sweat, tears, and a lot of complaining, we decided to switch over to this new topic. But much to our surprise, a couple of months ago, a similar but not identical systematic review by McNeely and colleagues was published in the Canadian Medical Association Journal. However, Corrine will go into more detail later on that ours focuses on quality of life, and they had a couple of factors. So, in 2006, 1 in 9 women will develop breast cancer, and 1/3 of these women will succumb to the disease. Breast cancer is the most commonly diagnosed cancer and is the number one cause of cancer deaths in Canadian women. However, with improved screening and adjuvant therapy, there's been an increase in survivorship. Mortality has been decreasing at about 2.7% per year since 1993. So because of this, there's a lot more women out there that are living as survivors of breast cancer that must face the and adjust to the changes that accompany the disease and treatment. And those are such things as disturbance in body image, decreased shoulder range of motion, depression, fatigue, weight gain, lymphedema, and anxiety. There's more, but I'm just going to stop at that. And all of these can contribute to a decrease in quality of life. So as I just mentioned, the numerous changes that occur will and can decrease quality of life. And I know that quality of life is a subjective measure, and there's many definitions, but after reading countless articles, we came up with one, which is the overall pleasure, comfort, and enjoyment in someone's life. So we looked at physical activity. Physical activity improves overall health, which has been shown to have an effect on mood and quality of life. This comes through many aspects and experiences such as socialization, goal setting, participation, decreased body weight, or decrease in fatigue. We found that an improvement in quality of life as a result of exercise can be noted in as little time as 4 to 8 weeks. So the purpose of our systematic review is to examine the effect of exercise of quality of life in women living with breast cancer. And we also hope to provide clinicians and women living with breast cancer a source to help them make informed decisions when prescribing and participating in physical activity.
Okay, so I'm going to briefly take you through our methods procedure and then start in on the results. So our initial search strategy was performed in November 2005. We chose to search the electronic databases Medline, Embase, CINAHL, PubMed, and PEDRO. And we used the key terms breast cancer and quality of life, or QOL, and exercise or physical activity, along with their associated terms, which varied between the databases. We were lucky enough to limit our searches to not only English, but French as well. And from our lit review, we knew that most of the research on breast cancer and exercise was fairly recent, so we didn't set any restrictions on the date of publication. We also looked at the reference lists of included articles to see if there was any additional relevant studies that were missed. So throughout the analysis and writing process, which concluded at the beginning of this month or the end of August, we also reran our searches and set up new alert emails through the databases to see if there was any new research that came out. So to start with, all articles underwent title and abstract screening, whereby we were able to eliminate articles that were completely irrelevant to the topic of our review. For the most part, articles that were excluded were ones that contained the words quality of life, exercise, and/or breast cancer, but that wasn't the sole topic of the article. Full text versions were then attained, and we went on to fully review these articles for our inclusion and exclusion criteria. All five authors partook in this process, however, only two authors looked at each individual article. And for a study to be included, it had to meet all of the following criteria. So the population was females diagnosed with breast cancer, or it could be a subgroup in the study of females with breast cancer. However, we had to be able to get the results from that data separately analyzed. The intervention was physical activity or exercise, which we defined as planned activity not related to a person's occupation or their activities of daily living. Our dependent variable was quality of life, and our outcome measure had to be a standardized quality of life outcome measure. And the study design had to be a randomized control trial, and also it had to be published in a peer-reviewed journal. So articles were excluded if they were review articles, descriptive, correlational, observational, or survey studies, unpublished dissertations, or abstracts, if physical activity or exercise was related to their occupation, to the subject's occupation, if physical activity or exercise intervention was carried out for less than 4 weeks, and if they did not use a standardized quality of life outcome measure tool. So to assess the methodological quality of the included studies, we used the Van Tolder criteria list for the methodological quality assessment established in 2003, which Dara will explain further when she discusses the results of our quality analysis. We also chose to use, like some of the other reviews, the Center for Evidence-Based Medicine Levels of Evidence, which is based off Sackett's 1993 Levels of Evidence. So now what you really want to hear are the results. So our initial search strategy resulted in the retrieval of 410 articles, which was quite overwhelming for us. But luckily, we were relieved to find out that right away, 178 were eliminated because they were duplicates, therefore leaving us 232 articles, which was still overwhelming. However, after the title and abstract screening, 155 were clearly unrelated and eliminated. And finally, after the full text versions were evaluated for our inclusion and exclusion criteria, 6 remained. And then also during our analysis and compiling our paper, 3 more articles were included. So that produced a grand total of 9 studies, which are listed here. So Siegel et al. In 2001, Cornea et al. In 2003, who's also a co-author of the systematic review that was just published in July. And then a local study by McKenzie and Calda in 2003, Heedley et al. In 2004, Mustian and colleagues in 2004, Campbell and colleagues in 2005, Sandel and colleagues in 2005, and O'Hara and colleagues, and Herrero and colleagues, both in 2006. So I just want to point out that the study sample sizes ranged from 14 to 123 subjects, and the mean age of the participants across the study were between 51 and 61 years of age. I'd also like to point out that the earliest study that was included was from 2001, with over half of our studies being published in the last year and a half. And this indicates that what we already knew, that research in this area is increasing, especially high quality research as shown by the increasing amount of randomized control trials.
Okay, so I'm just going to go over kind of our methodological assessment. So as Maureen was saying, we use the criteria list for methodological quality assessment, which taken from updated method guidelines for systematic reviews in the Cochrane Collaboration Back Review Group, which was written by Van Tolder and colleagues in 2003. And they recommended this criteria list for quality assessment as it had already been successfully used in a number of systematic reviews by that group. So these are the results, but I'll quickly explain the tool. It's made up of a list of 11 questions concerning internal validity, and the questions refer to an individual study's characteristics that may relate to various forms of biases. So for example, selection bias is assessed through questions regarding whether the methods of randomization were adequate and if the study implemented concealment of treatment allocation. And then another form of bias, detection bias, was assessed through questions regarding whether the outcome assessor was blinded to the intervention and if the timing of the outcome assessments was similar in all the groups, and so on. So the tool was used by 2 separate reviewers on each of our studies that we included in our systematic review. And so for each of the 11 questions, a yes, no, or unknown was given. And a total score was compiled with basically 1 point for every yes that a study received. If the article did not provide enough information for us to answer one of those quality indicators, then we contacted the respectable authors to see if they could clarify. And if they didn't get back to us, which actually many of them did, it was given an unknown. So after doing all that, we had an average of 95% inter-rater reliability using this tool. And any of the outstanding discrepancies were cleared up through discussion, usually with a lot of coffee and a lot of treats, or a third party, Susan, would come to our rescue and help us out if we needed her. So coming up to this that you see on the screen here, with a number of yeses, a poor methodological quality was if they had 0 to 3 yeses, and none of our studies fell into that category. 4 to 6 yeses was moderate quality, and so we had 4 studies in that, and 5 studies of high methodological quality. In addition, which we didn't have up here, but when using the CEBM's levels of evidence, which is like an update of the Sackett's levels, so we had 100% agreement, and we had 4 studies at level 1 and 5 studies at level 2. So, the physical activity or the intervention for each group. There is a huge range of protocols, which we'll discuss some of these limitations in the discussion component, and Corinne touches on that. But Aerobic, we had two studies that were just purely aerobic, and the time of that intervention, aerobic intervention, ranged from 8 weeks to 6.5 months. We had one study that did resistance only, and the time for that one was 6 months. And then we had three that did a combo of aerobic and resistance exercise, and they ranged from 8 to 12 weeks of intervention. And then we had three other ones, which were one each. So gentle arm exercises, which was implemented for 12 weeks, a dance and movement therapy, where participants attended for 12 weeks, and then a Tai Chi Chuan, which is like a series of slow repetitive movements, and that was also a 12-week long intervention. So, moving on. Okay, this is a fun slide. Okay. So, the quality of life outcome measures. We decided only to include validated outcome measures that were specific to quality of life. So any other assessment tools that were specific to self-esteem, like the Rosenberg self-esteem scale, fatigue, for example, the Piper fatigue scale, depression, like for example, the Center for Epidemiologic Studies depression scale, body image, happiness scales, anything like that, we did not include. We do recognize that all these components may contribute to one's quality of life, but we chose just to look at outcome measures that assess overall quality of life instead of possibly certain aspects of it. So we, after looking through all of our studies, we came up with a total of 7 different quality of life outcome measures that were used. So starting from the beginning, we have the Functional Assessment Cancer Therapy Breast, for short, the FACT-B. It was the most widely used tool we found in our studies, and it looks specifically at patients with breast cancer. So it's actually an extension of the next one down, the FACT-G, which is the same thing but general. So the FACT-B actually just has an extra subset of questions that makes it specific for breast cancer patients instead of just patients with any type of cancer. So we had 4 of our studies use the FACT-B, and then 3 of those same studies also used the FACT-G. And then another study used used the FACT-B, FACT-G, and also the satisfaction with life scale. So they were quite thorough. And then moving down, the Functional Assessment of Chronic Illness Therapy Fatigue Version 4, the FACET-F, was another one used in 2 of our studies. This scale is a specific scale that was developed for use in cancer clinical trials. And then 3 other studies used a more general quality of life tool, the Medical Outcomes Trust 36 Item Short Form Survey, which you guys probably all know as SF36. So 3 studies used that one. And then O'Hara and colleagues chose to use the CARES-SF, while last but not least, Herrero chose to use the European Organization for Research and Treatment of Cancer Questionnaire. So a wide variety, but all validated tools. So I'll pass you on to Karine.
Okay, so to start talking about our discussion, as Deanna had mentioned before, as we were writing our systematic review that was registered in the Cochrane database, we happened to come across an unregistered systematic review published by McNeely and colleagues in July of this year, titled The Effects of Exercise on Breast Cancer Patients and Survivors, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. And when we read this, we sort of thought, sounds a little bit like our topic. So then we frantically started reading the McNeely article, and I'm sure you're asking yourselves right now, well, how does this McNeely systematic review compare to our systematic review? Well, we would like to think that that's like comparing apples to oranges. While both are fruit, they each leave a different taste in your mouth, much like our systematic reviews. So, for starters, the McNeely Systematic Review had a much broader scope of focus and looked at studies that examine the effect of exercise on quality of life or cardiorespiratory function or physical functioning, and secondarily, fatigue and body composition. So, not all of the studies included in the McNeely Review article looked at quality of life or had a standardized quality of life measurement tool. Also, the McNeely article included studies that only had participants with breast cancer stages 0 to 3. So they excluded studies that had women with stage 4 breast cancer. That differs from our systematic review in that we examined studies that looked at the effect of a exercise program or physical activity on quality of life as measured by a standardized quality of life measurement tool. We also only included studies, we also included studies that had women with all stages of breast cancer. So what we were specifically looking at is the effect of exercise on quality of life in women with all stages of breast cancer. So as a result of our narrowed scope of focus, 8 of the studies that were included in the McNeely article were excluded from our systematic review, but 2 of the studies that were excluded from the McNeely article made all of our inclusion and exclusion criteria and so are included in our current review. Along with that, since the publication of the McNeely article in July of this year, 2 more studies have been newly published and are included in our review. So, all 9 of our included studies examined baseline characteristics and compared them between the intervention and control groups. And some of the baseline characteristics that were consistently noted were things like age, weight, height, race, education, marital status, the stage of breast cancer that the women had, the type of treatment they were undergoing, and what sort of initial activity level they had before the study. And for the majority of these studies, the control group and the intervention groups did not statistically differ. There were, however, 2 exceptions to this, one being the Heedley 2004 study and the other being the Mustian 2004 study. So in the Heedley study, the control group had a higher level of education and were more likely to be unmarried. So while Heedley and colleagues did not comment on the effect of education level on quality of life, they did speculate that since more control group women were unmarried, this may have resulted in a decrease in spousal support, which could help to account for this significantly larger decline in quality of life in the control group when compared to the intervention group, which Kathy will talk about a little bit later. Now, in the Mustian 2004 study, the intervention group had a higher level of self-esteem at baseline when compared to the control group. So this higher initial level of self-esteem may help to account for the significant improvement in quality of life in the intervention group and not the control group. Okay, so I'm going to pass it over to Kathy now.
It is important to note the limitations that arise upon comparing the results of the 9 studies included in our systematic review. While each of the studies examined an exercise or physical activity intervention, the types and intensities of exercises included in the studies vary greatly. Exercises range from gentle chair exercises to Tai Chi, Chuan, and dance and movement therapy to more rigorous exercises such as walking, aerobic training, and resistance training. While each of these forms of exercise fit into our inclusion criteria, because of the heterogeneity between the forms of exercises, they do create a challenge when trying to combine the data to provide future recommendations. Unfortunately, because of this, our results do not show what specific form of exercise may be recommended as most effective and safe for this population to improve quality of life. A second limitation in our review is related to the heterogeneity of the quality of life measurement tools used in the studies. All of the tools were standardized and valid. However, 7 different tools were used in the 9 studies, leaving us with results that were difficult to amalgamate as the domains in each of the tools differed. Therefore, we could only look at quality of life in general and could not remark on cumulative data from the different quality of life domains. We chose to look at all stages of breast cancer. 8 of our 9 studies included early through late stage breast cancer, including stages 1, 2, 3, and/or 3, while 1 sole study decided to look inclusively at stage 4 metastatic breast cancer. We included this study as stage 4 breast cancer has rarely been examined in the literature and do feel that it's still important to look at quality of life as an effect from exercise with this subpopulation. This did not affect our ability to report on the results of the exercise interventions as a whole. However, this was the only study that noted quality of life showing a decrease after exercise. Another study that differed from the others was by McKenzie et al. Instead of just looking at breast cancer solely, they decided to include breast cancer patients that also had unilateral lymphedema. This narrowed population was not able, we were not able to generalize the results to the rest of the breast cancer population, as only a percentage of breast cancer patients will ever get lymphedema. Two further limitations to note are with regards to the inability of the studies to blind the patients to the intervention groups, and with the small sample sizes in most of the studies, which did affect the power of the results. As I just mentioned, because of the wide variety of exercise interventions used within the 9 studies, we are not able to report on the most optimal exercise intervention. Specifically, what frequency, intensity, type, and time is most effective for the breast cancer population. However, of the 9 studies, quality of life was shown to improve either significantly or show an important trend towards improvement in all of the studies. In only 1 study, which looked solely at stage 4 metastatic breast cancer, did quality of life actually show a decrease over the duration of the study. But these results are not surprising in consideration of the severity of the stage of the disease. And it must be noted that although the results showed a decrease, the intervention group did not decrease as much as the control group, therefore again showing a trend that exercise does positively affect quality of life in women living with breast cancer. It would be beneficial for future studies to choose a form of exercise that has already been researched so we could build a stronger case for what specific types of exercises are the most beneficial for this population. Though, as in any disease, patients are of different ages, have different stages of the disease, have gone through different treatment and surgeries. So it is difficult to conclude what specific type of exercise will be the best option for each and every individual. However, the research to date is building a strong case that does indicate that exercise is suitable and safe for women living with breast cancer, and that women who engage in a variety of forms of physical activity or exercise are reporting an increased quality of life as compared to those who do not participate. Exercise is consistently being found to be a positive predictor of quality of life following breast cancer diagnosis and treatment. Physical therapists must continue to monitor and partake in current research publications and continue to build upon this growing body of knowledge. This topic is still fairly young in its research inception and can be expected to provide stronger recommendations in the near future. As for present day, it is important for us to be aware of what we will recommend to our patients in the clinical setting and to help other clinicians and women living with breast cancer make informed decisions when prescribing or participating in physical activity. And we must remind ourselves to be cautious when prescribing exercises and continue to teach our patients to monitor themselves for lymphedema. Though we are not able to report on a specific type of exercise that is found to be the most effective in improving quality of life in women living with breast cancer, we can conclude that exercise or physical activity in general does show to improve quality of life in this special population.
So I just want to thank you all for sticking with it, and I know it's almost past lunchtime. We'd also like to thank Susan Harris for all her help. She attended all our meetings, and she was always available by email, even though she gets about 1 million a day. We also like to thank all the other authors who we had corresponded with, because they were pretty good at getting back to us. And yeah, that will take us to any questions.
So the question is, for the 12-week intervention, why did they choose 12 weeks, and were they given any instructions after 12 weeks? So we actually had more than one study that had 12 weeks as their intervention. I think there were Yeah, there's at least three and possibly four. They didn't always say why. A lot of them, quality of life wasn't always the primary outcome measure, so sometimes they would say that just to give enough time for physiological changes if they were measuring, had any other measurements. Sometimes it was just convenience for, say, getting a group together just to do a three-month program, so for maybe having better adherence in a shorter amount of time. But I don't think a lot of them really explained why they would choose 6, 8, or 12 weeks besides that, unless you want to add something.
I'll just add that we found by Gosselin, he noted that it takes about 4 to 8 weeks minimum to see an improve in quality of life after exercise. So they may have taken that into account as well. Alrighty.
Okay. I'll ask one other question if no one else has questions. I was wondering about your quality of life outcome tools. Was there any indication whether some of those were better at 8 weeks out versus 6.5 months out? Those were your
parameters? So the question is, were any of the outcome measures, was it stated anywhere whether they were better after a certain amount of time, I think,
like
expression. So whether it was more for short-term or a long-term follow-up, if they were better at any point in time. And no study addressed that at all. So, and even when we look through the studies, there isn't even an indication that would give us an idea of why we would even choose one over the other. I think maybe it just might be whether the group of people putting on the study were just familiar with a particular outcome measure, and maybe the length of time and the ease of giving it to people, but no one ever addressed whether, say, the FACB was better for short-term follow-up versus long-term follow-up.
Okay, well. And also, one of the limitations to the studies is that there is no really long-term follow-up. A lot of these are quite short-term, so that could be something to add in the next, if people are going to do more research, to do more long-term follow-up to figure that out. Okay.
Oh. I just the study that involved women with metastatic breast cancer, was it solely women with metastatic breast cancer? Wow. Because I want to do an update on exercise for metastatic cancer, because there are only about 10.
They had 38. Something.
There are only about 10 papers out there, though, in PubMed, so that's good for them. And that wasn't in the previous meta-analysis.
No, they only
did
1, 2, 3.
Yeah.
Okay. Mike?
Any other?
Are the therapy that they did, the physical activity, was it all, did they do it individually, like, or was it all group type exercise? And or what are some of the examples of the physical, I don't know if I missed that, but some of the examples of the physical activity?
There was such a wide, the question was, with regards to the different types of exercises, were they within groups or were they done individually or how were they completed? There were a variety, as I mentioned, of different exercise options. A lot of the studies each had a different exercise regime than the other. One of the groups, for instance, had supervised, another one had a take-home exercise. Some of them came to aerobic classes where there was, say, 14 of them together. Others were, again, given a resistance training, but they were shown initially and then were had to follow up on their own at a center. So it was a huge variety.
I'd just like to add to that. So the one with stage 4 breast cancer was the gentle arm exercise one. And also, so six of the studies had supervision for the whole exercise program. Two of them had supervision for the first half of the program, whether it be 3 weeks or 3 months, dependent on the study, and only one didn't have supervision. And that happened to be the gentle arm exercises, because it was a video, that's why.
Could you comment on the adherence in the exercise regimes, and was there any relationship between adherence and the type of exercise program that was offered?
So the question was, can we comment on adherence and whether there's any relationship between adherence levels and outcome? So actually, in most of the studies, adherence was pretty good. One of our quality indicators on Van Tolder was sort of yes, no, or unknown whether, and it uses the word compliance, was adequate. And we set compliance as being adequate at approximately 65%, just through doing, that's what they suggested in the article, so that's what we used. And we actually, I think all of ours were almost above 70%, which is actually pretty good. We had some that were like in the 80s. One, the cornea in 2003 was 98.4% for the exercise group, which is actually really good. None of them actually related the adherence to outcomes, and I think probably because the adherence was usually pretty good and the outcomes were usually positive, so they didn't really dive into that and try to explain or make a relationship. I don't know if anybody else wanted me to add.
Just a follow-up, could you tell us what cornea did to have, you know, what was it about their study that got the 98% compared to a study that got 65% adherence?
Can guesstimate. Okay, so the question is maybe why was the adherence so good in corneas 2003? So they did recumbent or upright cycle ergometer for 15 weeks, and they only did measures at baseline and at the end. So it could have been just because of the short time period, because they didn't have to redo the outcome measures so many times, because some of them did it like every 2 weeks, and maybe it was just hard to keep people coming back for that, and I'm not sure, go ahead.
And the time period for the length of the actual exercise intervention was one of the shorter amounts, and it varied between 25 to 45 minutes, where a lot of our other ones were up to an hour, so that could have contributed to it.
Did anyone comment about quality of life for group exercises versus individual? As in maybe doing it as a group improves your quality of life?
Well, I think the question is whether if it seemed that group exercise was better for quality of life versus non-group. So none of the actual studies commented on that because they never actually compared a group exercise to individual. The study was either group exercise or individual. But I think out of a lot of the studies came a lot of qualitative comments from participants saying that they really enjoyed experience going through this with others who've been through the same experiences, and kind of like a sense of camaraderie, and that kind of just creating that support network through participating. So
they mentioned like the quality or the magnitude of change of quality of life from base to end.
Oh, like the significant values that they got in some of them?
Group versus individual.
Oh, we don't have any for group versus individual. It's just with each individual study that would give it a significance or not. So it would be really interesting if someone did do a comparison of individual exercise versus group exercise, I think.
And also just to add to that, a lot of the groups that were in the research, they actually carried on by themselves after the research, and they carried on as groups. And I'm not sure how they are doing now, but yeah.
Everybody's hungry.
I attend lots of conferences, and I've heard a lot of my peers present at conferences, well, probably 3 zillion times in the last 30 years. And I know Brenda's here, and I think there's some other senior people here. These are on a par with the best presentations I've heard at professional conferences. All four this morning, the quality of the PowerPoint, the sharing of the information, your knowledge in handling the questions, your understanding of the area, any one of that. You know, tomorrow's the deadline for submitting to WCPT. I mean, any one of these should be presented as a paper if you have the time to do it, or as a longer paper. I'm just really, really overwhelmed with the quality, and I thank you all, and we will see you. Oh, before